Welcome once again to Chatham Community Church. My name is Jaime. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm glad to see y'all here this morning. I want to extend a particularly warm welcome to those of you who are guests. If this is your first time with us, or it's been a while, we're so glad that you're with us, and we do hope that you grab one of our welcome bags on your way out. If you didn't get one on your way in, they'll be just outside the exit doors. Come stop by there. I'll be there. You'll say hi at the end of the service, and we'll make sure we get you some information about us. So as you're discerning or figuring out whether this is a good place for you to spend your time on Sunday mornings while you're in Chatham County, you have all the information that you need. We are over-communicating some changes that are coming, so we're going to go over some slides very quickly that you already saw today. We just want to make sure that all this information is in front of you and you have it accessible to you as we get ready for the changes that are coming at the start of the new year. So we are joining forces, both campuses, into one location for a season as we get ready to relaunch the Pittsboro campus, which currently meets here at the East Street location next to where the True Value is. So as part of that, we are closing up shop here at the end of this year and moving up to the North Chatham campus. We'll worship as one church in one location for a season. And that season has sort of two main components to it. There is the building side as we get ready, the East Street location, and then there's the people side as we invest in ourselves as a community, because the goal is that our time together as one church in one location leaves both campuses better when we go back to being one church in two locations. That the North Chatham campus is better poised to reach the people in North Chatham, and that the Pittsboro campus is better poised to reach the people in Pittsboro in this next season. So this is the map. We're working the plan. We want you to know where we're at. We're in phase one on both instances. We'll update this as things go along. A recent update that I can give you is that as part of the East Street location, there's the big space where we're going to worship, where there's going to be Chatham Kids, we're going to be where there's be hospitality that we have to do sort of upfit and renovation. And then there's space next to it that we're doing no work on because it's currently ready to be used or as offices and small meeting spaces. We are almost cleared to have a certificate of occupancy there. So we passed two inspections for that space this week. We're hoping that another one is passed in the near future, and we're hoping to have access and use of that space before the new year. So you can pray for that. We're praising God for that, but want you to know where we're at. As part of this process, there are a couple of dates we want you to be aware of. They've already been covered, and we cover them again. Our last Sunday worshiping here is December 21st, but we will be worshiping here on Christmas Eve and on the 23rd. So those services will happen here. The 28th is an online-only worship service. And then on January 4th, we are starting up, rolled together, at the North Chatham campus. Both campuses worshiping together as one church. And as part of that, all service times are going to be different. All service times are going to be different. It'll be 8:30, 10, and 11:30. We are repeating this every week until we're done with our time here, because of a number of reasons. One, we know that with all the hustle and bustle of the Christmas and New Year season, we know some of you are going to wake up on one of these Sunday mornings and think that there is a 9:45 service. There isn't a 9:45 service, but it's okay if you show up for a mythical 9:45 service. You'll catch the end of one of the services and the beginning of the other one. That's totally fine. There'll be no judgment. We expect that to happen. We also know that there are people who are going to show up here for services on January 18th. I can almost guarantee that that's going to happen. We are going to have signs ready for that, but we want to invite you, because it's not you. You're not going to show up here on January 18th, but you know the people who are going to show up here on January 18th. They're not here today, and they're going to forget these announcements. So send them this stuff. Help them. Help them. Help them get to North Chatham as we're gathered together on January 18th. Again, starting 8:30, 10, and 11:30, starting January 4th. When I was in grade school, I don't remember if it was third or fourth grade. It was one of those two. My whole class was really excited about our social studies class because it was the first time we were going to have this teacher. And this teacher was super well-known, super well-loved, super well-respected. She was like a ray of sunshine. And we had her for maybe the first month of school, and then she left. Now, we didn't realize that, but she was going on maternity leave. And so she was gone. And we had a sub for a little bit. And a couple of weeks after that, this one teacher shows up and lets us know, we'd never seen her before, she's new, lets us know that our teacher is not coming back. She's not coming back after maternity. And that she'd been hired to be our new teacher. And this teacher was nothing like the other teacher that we had. This teacher raised her voice and, in fact, yelled. This teacher got physical with one of our classmates and, in fact, a few more. This teacher taught very aggressively and spoke very demeaningly towards us. If you've ever seen or read about Matilda, it felt very much like the principal in that story. And it completely changed the atmosphere in that classroom where we had entered that year looking forward to our social studies class and looking forward to that teacher. If you had walked into our classroom while this teacher was there, it would have looked something like this. Anyone would have said, well, this teacher has great control of the classroom. No one spoke, but we didn't speak out of fear. Like everyone was afraid to get it wrong. Everyone was afraid to be her target. And, you know, for a while, we didn't say anything, right? We were kids. We were conditioned to listen to our teachers, to obey, to follow along. And listen, every other teacher I had in school was a wonderful teacher. Every other teacher I had in school was worth listening to, engaging, and obeying. But it took us a while to realize that this teacher was actually worth us telling our parents that something was up. So about a month after she arrived, she was no longer around. She was no longer around, and we got a new teacher that wasn't as good as the original teacher, but as soon as that new teacher stepped into a room, as soon as we had their first class with that new teacher, the atmosphere changed to look something like this. Before, it looked calm. It looked peaceful, but there was no peace. There was internalized anxiety. There was no learning happening, even though none of us were speaking and all of us were facing forward. But when this new teacher came in, the atmosphere changed. And now we were engaging. Now we were attending. Now we were learning. Now it felt peaceful for all the right reasons. It's like all of us took a collective breath and all this anxiety we were carrying left. Have you ever had an experience like that where you've been in a space, maybe it was the classroom, maybe it was a relationship, maybe it was your business or your job, or maybe it was a team, where it felt tense and chaotic all the time, where it felt like you were on edge, on pins and needles, walking on eggshells all the time, and it was because of the person who was in charge. Because they created an atmosphere that maybe demanded acquiescence, demanded obedience, but really there was no peace. All it was fear. Do you remember what it felt like when that person was no longer in charge? Maybe you moved on to a new grade. Maybe there was a new coach. Maybe you moved on to a new relationship or that person changed. Do you remember when that new person came in, how it felt? How it felt like you could take a breath. How it felt like you could exist. How it felt like, oh, this is the way things ought to be. Things are supposed to be. How it felt peaceful. Didn't that person's presence feel like a gift? That with just a change in the person who's in charge and how they carry themselves, the whole atmosphere can change. In the weeks leading up to Christmas, we're going to be focusing on a gift of presence because presence can make a real difference. We're actually focusing on the greatest gift of presence ever given. And it wasn't a gift given just to one person or one group of people at one time. It was a gift given to all of humanity, to all of the world, to all of existence for all time. The gift is the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, God with us, Emmanuel, the indescribable gift. We're calling it indescribable not because we don't use words. We do use words to try and describe, but our words are never enough to fully explain the impact of God's presence with us, of God taking on flesh. In Jesus, God steps fully into our world. God doesn't exist in our world simply as an idea or as a concept. God enters our world as a person, one born into real time, one born into a place where with real struggle, who goes through real struggle, one who experiences and gives real love, one who experiences real loss, and one who brings real and lasting redemption, far-reaching redemption, redemption that reaches every corner of human life and of existence. So for these next few weeks, we're going to look at the significance of the Emmanuel, the significance of God with us, the significance of what in theological terms is known as the incarnation, and how we might receive the gift of God's presence for us and for those around us this Christmas season. One of the implications of the Emmanuel, of God with us, of God taking on flesh in Jesus, is that in him, in the coming of Jesus, peace arrives. Through Jesus, peace comes. Now, when the ancients would have read the word peace or talked about the word peace, the Hebrew word they'd use or they'd think of or they'd feel in their gut is the word shalom. And shalom has a far more wide-reaching sense of what it means than simply the ceasing of hostilities, which is how we often use peace nowadays. Shalom is more than a state of not being at each other's throats. Shalom implies a sense of well-being that is all-encompassing. It's a sense of well-being that is experienced when things are as they ought to be. It's a sense of rightness. It feels like, oh yes, this is right. This is how it should be. And Jesus ushers in that sense of rightness. He ushers in that kind of peace. He ushers in shalom. Today we step into a passage that doesn't feel like it has very much in the way of shalom. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good. But it highlights the very need. It highlights the necessity, the need that our world had for the coming of one who could bring real shalom, real peace, a real sense of rightness, a true sense of well-being. Jesus, Emmanuel, the gift of God. Now let me locate us in the narrative. The passage that we heard read occurs sometime after Jesus' birth. He's somewhere between infant and young toddler. The Magi, or the wise men, have been to visit him and his family. And Herod the Great, who is the king over the region of Judea, he's been placed there by Rome. Remember, or if you're not familiar, Rome is over this whole area. This is part of the Roman Empire. Rome controls not just this region, but all surrounding regions, has installed Herod as king of Judea. And Herod is waiting in Jerusalem for the Magi to come back. Because the Magi stopped in Jerusalem and said, "We've seen a star. The king of the Jews has been born. Where is he?" And Herod says, "Oh, go find out where he is and come back and tell me that I might go and worship the king of the Jews." Now, in our text, it doesn't have the quotation marks, but the quotation marks are there in our hearts. Because he's not serious. There is no intent for him to go worship, but he wants them to come back. And as time passes, it becomes clear that the Magi aren't coming back. That they're not coming back to tell him where this king of the Jews is. Now, historically, Herod is known for a couple of things. One thing he's known for is massive building projects. He would use his power, he would use his influence, he would use his authority to build big things, right? One of the things he did was he rebuilt and expanded the temple in Jerusalem. This was one of his calling cards. And the other thing he's known for is an obsession with consolidating and maintaining his power and his position. Herod was known for ruthlessly eliminating any perceived threats to his power wherever he perceived them to be coming from. And if he perceived them as coming from his family, guess what? He took out people from his family as well. And so he did. So what you've got is you've got a person with a lot of authority, a lot of power, as ruler in this region, and he feels that his rule is being threatened by this purported king of the Jews that's been born. He feels that maybe his life is being threatened, and he finds himself now outwitted and made a fool of by some foreign travelers. So what is someone in Herod's position to do? I mean, what else could he do? Lots of things. Herod could have done lots of other things besides what he actually does. There are so many other things that Herod could have chosen to do in this situation. Some of them might have even kept him in power as king of Judea, which is clearly one of his goals. It's clearly one of his objectives here. He wanted the stability of the situation to remain. He wanted his reign to remain. He wanted his own peace, his own well-being to remain intact at the coming of this king of the Jews. He could have done so many things, some of which could have even secured this. But what he does is he uses his power, uses the extent of his power, the extent of his authority to secure himself at great cost to those around him, unimaginable cost to those around him. And what he doesn't bring, even as he maintains his situation, even as his well-being is kept, even as he is in somewhat peace, there is no shalom. There's no shalom with Herod's actions. There's a phrase, whose popularity is due to comic books, but whose roots trace their origins millennia. They lightly date back thousands of years. And that phrase is, with great power comes great responsibility. Like I said, the popularity of this phrase finds its root in the comic book world, but it is one of those timeless truths that transcends the media where it gained its popularity, because this statement is weighty. This statement is weighty, and we feel the rightness, the truth, and the weightiness of this statement whenever we see the ripple effects of poor decisions made by those in power and authority. Whenever those in power and authority make poor decisions and its implications stretch out far beyond them, we feel the truth of this statement. But what's also true is this. You don't need to have great power to have responsibility over that power. With whatever degree of power we have, there is a measure of responsibility to steward that power well. And all of us have differing degrees of power and authority throughout our lives. We make decisions. We affect change. We say things or refrain from saying things. We take actions and cease taking actions. We create ripple effects. With every decision, every word, every action that we do or don't do that affect not just us, but affect those around us. So take a moment and think about the last week in your life. Think about all the things that you did or didn't do. Think about all the decisions that you made or didn't make. Think about all the things you said or didn't say. Think about the efforts that you invested yourself in or chose not to invest yourself in. Think about them. Think about the ripple effects. Maybe you can trace the clear benefits for yourself and for those closest to you. Maybe you can see how these decisions, these words, these actions affected things for good. Hear me, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with making decisions, saying things, doing things that bring about good for you and those closest to you. The question is that I want you to consider now is, did you in those decisions also contribute to the peace, to the well-being, and to the shalom of those around you? Not just those closest to you, but those beyond that first inner circle, or maybe even that second inner circle. Or did you cost them peace and well-being? Did your well-being come at the cost of others' well-being? Hear me. It is not an either or in the kingdom of God. It is not either decisions affect you and hurt others, or you hurt yourself for the sake of the well-being of others. The two are not mutually exclusive. One does not have to come at the cost of the other, and that's one of the ways of to think about what it looks like to steward whatever power we have well. The true measure of whether we stewarded our power well is, did we contribute to shalom? To the peace and to the well-being, to the sense of rightness, that this is how things ought to be, not just for us, and not just for those closest to us, but for those beyond. Or did we cost them that? Because listen, friends, if all we can say is that we brought shalom to ourselves, but not to others, and we actually cost them shalom, we didn't bring shalom to ourselves. Because true shalom is big enough, it's whole enough, it's encompassing enough to benefit us and to benefit those around us. It is not a limited quantity. It is very clear in this passage that Herod is not contributing to shalom. Before the passage, he lies to the Magi about his intentions towards the king of the Jews. Lying, no shalom. No shalom comes from lying. Then, when he's outwitted, he sends out forces to terrorize families and massacre innocents. He kills children, none of whom were any real threat to him, none of whom posed any danger to him. This is so far from shalom, so far from well-being, so far from how it ought to be, that we naturally react in horror whenever we come across this story. So let's drill down a bit. Let's get to the core of what is going on in Herod. Let's look at some of the root things that lead out to this terrible, terrible situation. What we see when we look at Herod is likely someone who is feeling threatened, fearful, and insecure. And those don't form a recipe for peace and well-being. There is no shalom out of actions taken from a sense of being threatened, fearful, or insecure. This is not a mix that you end up using your power for shalom with. When he hears that the king of the Jews has been born, all he seems to see is a threat to his power. All he seems to see is his own end. He can't seem to imagine a future in which this prophesied king would end up doing anything different than what he does. All he seems to be wrapped up in his position as king of Judea, and he will do anything to secure that position and maintain his power. He can't seem to imagine that this king of the Jews won't treat him like he would treat him. And he can't seem to be seen as weak. And he can't be seen as a fool. So when he is outwitted by the Magi, he can't wait. Now, he could have engaged in other efforts to find this king of the Jews, but he reacts in this moment. He can't let rumors start going around that he can be taken for a fool. He has to assert his dominance, which speaks to his insecurity. He seems to be fearful of what might happen if he doesn't assert himself. So what does he do? He demeans, he uses, and he sacrifices others for the sake of protecting himself. He fails to see the people around him as made in the image of God. He doesn't recognize their inherent value and worth. He has no imagination for what people made in the image of God are capable of doing when they don't choose to be at their worst. You don't have to be at your best to do better than Herod. You can be marginally decent and still come across with a different outcome, but Herod can't seem to imagine anyone being anywhere other than at their worst, which is where he's at. That means he can't see the image of God in them. He has no vision for that. He can't see the inherent value or worth in the communities of Jews that he is ruling over, so he instills in them fear. He instills fear in an already oppressed community. Think of what those towns, that Bethlehem and those towns surrounding that, might have felt like during those days. Soldiers marching through the town, knocking on doors, maybe knocking doors down, asking you how old your boys are. And if they are under 2, pulling them away and ending their lives. This is not shalom. This is not how things ought to be. And the devastation doesn't last for however long the actual massacre takes. I want you to imagine your graduating class and imagine yourselves, say, in the 9th grade. I went to school, the same school, from K through 9 and had basically the same group of kids around me. I can picture those classes. Imagine those class pictures of your time in school and imagine that all the boys suddenly disappear. But it's not just the boys in those pictures. It's the boys in the class ahead of you and the class behind you. That's what he was doing. What does that do to a school? What does that do to a community? That doesn't go away after a few days. that devastation lasts for years. And this is not shalom. This is not how it ought to be. Herod also uses those under his command to carry out his brutality. He doesn't do it himself. He invites others to be instruments of his violence, horror, of his insecurity, and of his fear. Now, I'm not saying those people had no agency. They could have made different choices, and they made choices here. But Herod orders them to do something that corrodes their soul. And this is not shalom, and this is not how it ought to be. Herod's status quo is maintained, and he does it quickly. He's effective and efficient as a leader. But in using his power, there isn't any real peace. There isn't shalom. He does not steward his power well because he is fearful, insecure, and threatened. Now, we don't have Herod's power, and Lord willing, we never go to the places he did, but all of us have been threatened, fearful, and insecure at one point or another in our lives. Maybe we've been feeling that way recently. Maybe we're feeling that way in one or more areas of our lives right now. There is certainly a lot in society that is stoking that, and a lot that is thriving on maintaining us in places of fear, of threat, and of insecurity. So my question is, is it getting hard for you to see the image of God in others? Are there groups of people you're having a hard time recognizing the image of God in? Are you numb or turning a blind eye to the mistreatment of some? Are you perpetuating some of that mistreatment? Are you standing by as some are corroding their souls through their actions? Are you feeling hurt, threatened, or insecure? Folks, we are all prone to these, but none of us have to stay there. And none of us have to use whatever power we have or allow others to use their power out of these things either. None of us have to settle with the chaos and devastation these things bring to our souls and to those around us. When they were under five, we were playing a game with some of our nieces and nephews, and one of them was teaching us the game. It was a game they made up, and let me tell you, it was a creative game. It was fun, confusing, but fun. And we came to a point in the game, and one of them makes this move that puts them ahead of all of us, really well positioned to win, but it wasn't a move that they had taught us. So naturally, we go, wait a second. We protest a little bit. And they say, oh, yeah, I forgot to explain that, but that's a move you can do. Okay, fair enough. They're explaining the game on the fly. Now, I'm a gamer, and I care about winning, so I start to pay attention. And I find myself in a position to make that same move and to get really ahead and to position myself for the win. So I make the move. No, the child protests. You can't do that. And I'm puzzled. I go, what are you talking about? You just did the same thing a little while ago. Oh, yeah, only I can do that. Their game, their rules. All the power, all the authority, and using it to secure themselves. Herod is, in some ways, an anomaly, but the roots of where Herod starts are not. So I ask you again, are there places where you feel threatened, where you feel fearful, where you feel insecure? Are you acting out of those places? Because these are not a recipe for shalom, for well-being, or for goodness. How are you using the power and authority that you have? In the passage, Herod does it in violent ways. And there are ways that are anti-shalom. King Herod uses his power to violently try to take out the Prince of Peace. But nothing that he does is enough to frustrate the work of God. And this is the good news. It doesn't matter how many actions are taken out of fear, out of threat, out of violence, out of insecurity. The work of God stands. In Jesus, the Prince of Peace has come. Shalom has come. Well-being has come. And what we see in the coming of Jesus, in the way God works in this passage, in the rest of Jesus' life, in the ultimate fulfilling of things, is a counter, not just to Herod, but to everything that is at the root of how Herod commits this horrendous act of violence. this massacre of the innocents. God has all authority and power. Jesus has all authority and power. And when Jesus enters into this world, he enters it with no violence, no weapons, needing others to care for him, others to protect him. He is completely dependent, completely vulnerable, needs Mary and Joseph to act on his behalf, needs the Magi to act on his behalf, because the threat is real. And Jesus, as a baby, can do nothing about it. Again, all power and authority and complete dependence. Herod has everything going for him and acts like he's about to lose it all. He acts out of desperation. Jesus seemingly lets go of so much of all that he has by taking on flesh and coming like a child, but neither in this instance nor at any point in his life is there ever a sense that he is desperate. Never a sense that he acts out of that desperation. When Herod is outwitted, he responds in rage. When Jesus is mocked, beaten, when he ends up crucified, he doesn't respond in rage. He prays forgiveness for those who are acting against him. While Herod fails to see the image of God in those around them and devalues them, when he doesn't think that they'll do anything different than the worst that they're capable of, Jesus sees and calls out the value of everyone he encounters. And no matter what path and how crooked it is they find themselves in, he calls them forth to a better path because he believes they can live a better life if they follow him. Where Herod uses his power to order people in ways that corrode their souls, God calls people, and Jesus calls people into trusting partnership that blesses them and brings shalom to all of those around him. Herod tries to take Jesus' life, but Jesus ultimately gives it himself. Herod thinks the death of the king of the Jews will ultimately secure his power, but what the death of the king of the Jews ultimately does is secure life in abundance for all time, the ultimate triumph over death and sin for all of us. Herod lives without any apparent accountability in this instance, but he is accountable. This act is recorded and remembered. The children who lost their lives may be nameless in this passage, but they are not forgotten by God and they are not forgotten by the church. God knows each of them. History mourns them. Herod is not remembered as great, but is cruel and insecure. See, no act of violence or injustice goes unnoticed in the eyes of the Lord. Every wrong will be made right. Justice is and will be done. And God ultimately holds every perpetrator of every evil act and every cruel action to account. Herod will lose his life. He will lose his kingdom. It will be broken up. What he tries to hold on to will slip through his fingers. His false peace will crumble. But Jesus ushers in the life that is lived to the fullest for all time. And it is enough for everyone. He ushers in true peace, true rightness, true shalom, true well-being. And ours is to receive it. The invitation for us today, for us today who are tempted to use power in any way to secure ourselves, is to actually model after Jesus and use our power through sacrificial love. Actually affect good change through sacrificial love. So today, wherever you find yourself embracing a path of false peace, that is rooted in feeling threatened, that is rooted in being fearful, that is rooted in insecurity, the invitation is to turn away from it and to turn towards the one who brings true shalom and receive the peace, the well-being, the rightness that comes through him. The invitation today is to live out of the true peace that is found only in Jesus and to receive that blessing for yourself into those around you. In a moment, we're going to gather around the table of the Lord. But what we do at the table is remember Jesus' sacrificial love, the love that brought forth true peace. I'm going to invite those of you who are communion table hosts to go to your tables now. What we're going to do in a moment is I'm going to pray for us, and then you're going to go to the tables and gather up one of those gluten-free crackers and one of those cups of grape juice and go back to your seat. This is something that Christians around the world have celebrated for generations. So if you are following Jesus in any way, we invite you to come to the table. You'll gather the elements, you'll come to your seats, and I'll come back up and lead us in the retelling of the story of that first communion and invite us to reflect on its significance for us, especially today, as we examine this passage. Let me pray, and then you are free to go to the tables. Come, Lord Jesus. Break through fear, break through insecurity, break through a sense of threatenedness, and come meet us with your true peace, God. May we come to the table in freedom, in joy, in trust. Amen and amen.